That's session number 11422, Reel 2.
The final one then, of course, was what you aimed for, was what was called the top-class deck man. Now, these were the moneyed men. These were the smoke room steward, the assistant smoke room stewards, the lounge stewards, the reading room men, the card room men, in fact, all the upper echelon of leisure rooms where passengers sat there preparatory to dinner, drinking and talking and being served drinks and library and all like that. These men really made the money because they were getting tipped all the time. They didn't have to wait till the end of the voyage.
Because the customers were paying in cash.
That's correct. And then, therefore, they got the extra. Well, they wouldn't give those men sixpence. They'd give those a shilling because they were faultlessly dressed and they had the bowing, scraping way of, thank you, sir, yes. And they'd long ago lost their inner city accent, I can assure you. And then the best job of the lot then was barkeeper. The man who served the humble drinks behind the bar was generally the richest man in the ship.
Really?
Because he fiddled his drinks and he added money to bills when he shouldn't have done. And that's how he made his money, out of fiddling the drinks. And also, for instance, if a person wanted a common bottle of beer, it was all bottled beer in those days, particularly before the advent of lager. And when you poured out the bottle of beer, there was always about a tenth of it left in the bottle. But you never, ever served a bottle with a drink. That was horrific. You would serve the glass of drink, and that was it, and beer. And all those tenths of a bottle were all poured into one bottle, you see, and that was served. And that was one way with bottled drinks. They were given short measure in spirits and all like that because they weren't there to see. They are typical.
Well, these are the measures.
Pre-war measures.
Yes.
That's a single.
Yes.
And say it's government stamped.
Yes.
They made a pewter.
Yeah.
And that was a double, that was a single. Well, but they were never filled up properly, you see. And then they always had soda water or ginger or something like that in it, you see.
So the mixer was in it before it went to the table.
That's correct. And plus the cherry on a stick, which helped to fill up the glass.
Yeah.
You never, ever did the cardinal sin of the shore licensee. You never really gave them a very low measure, which pubs do ashore.
Yeah.
You gave them just that little microscopic couple of drops less than they should have received. Because some of the men could discern, they'd been drinking, say, gin or brandy that long, and that they'd soon discern if it was the less measure, especially if they ordered the neat brandy, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's another thing which you had to be very, very careful of was you never served a cheap whiskey when passengers had ordered a certain type of whiskey. Well, you never ever tried to substitute another, because generally a person who specifically asked for black and white or something like that, they've been drinking it for years and they could discern it very, very quickly. See what I mean? So you had to be very careful, but you're still there. He was still making the money out of short serving all the time.
Because it'd be that much
soon. That's right. And when they used to have cocktail parties, well, an American millionaire would say, "We're having a cocktail party tonight consisting of 10 people." So you'd fix up tables in a corner of the smoke room, and the waiter would pay special attention to those 10. And the American would say, "And I want you to give me the aggregate bill at the next morning." After where that was really asking for trouble, wasn't it? The American would immediately, you'd immediately shove $5 on top of that bill, or maybe even more.
Yeah.
And that's how you, and really short measure those, because people are sitting down to a free party. They're not going to say to the waiter, "This is only a little whiskey, this," or, you know, obviously, because it's free. And this was another angle from which barkeepers made money, but they were the richest men in the ship.
So the real money would be made on the transatlantic the Western Ocean.
Oh, yes.
Not so much on any of the other passenger trades.
Not as much as the other passenger trades. The other passenger trades were not as much as you made on the Western Ocean, because that was the money run.
Where the people who
that's right.
A lot of
that's right. If you were on the, say, Elder Dempster's, which, as I say, carried a lot of executive officers and government people down to the colonies and all that, they tipped, but they only tipped the English way. Just they give you a certain amount, and that was it. For instance, now England from Liverpool down to West Africa, that was £1. That was the recognised price, and you never received any more, you never received any less, but it was there. But it was longer.
Were there fewer stiffs on those ships?
Fewer stiffs on those ships, because, you see, they were a very regular trade. They used to come home for 3 months, leave, and they're going down with their wives. And they'd come back, you know, sometimes they'd send the wives home a couple of weeks ahead of the husband, so as to get the home ready and all like that, you see. And you gradually got to know them. They were regular on the run, you see. And you had to be very, very discreet. For instance, the wife would be sent home, and the husband would wave her away on the quay in Lagos, and the ship would sail, and the wife would be going home by herself, but she was known as a single lady then, stewardess looked after. Well, now, the lady travelling home in the hot, humid nights, and she'd be in an evening dress with her hair beautiful, manicured, looked after, and her nails manicured. She looked, it was a woman's world, those big mail boats, especially in the evening. They had nothing to do but to look glamorous all the time, because they didn't have to do anything else. Merely to look glamorous, and meals were brought to them and all like that. And there were lots of men travelling on their own, so the inevitable happened. The meeting on the boat deck and all like that. Well, you get a single man. This man would be perhaps travelling on his own, going home to join his wife. Well, perhaps when he went in to make his bed next morning, you'd find his pyjamas would be rolled up and just chucked to the bottom. And as you were adjusting the pillows, you'd find a pair of ladies' knickers under his panties, under his pillow, you know. Didn't bother you, he didn't even quibble an eyebrow. You simply took the panties, and you knew which girl knew which lady he was sort of cavorting around with at that time. You simply took her panties, and he went along to the stewardess who was in charge of her room, and you gave her the panties, and the stewardess said, thank you, and she put the panties back under the lady's pillow. Now, the lady come in, and she'd realise she'd left her panties in the man's cabin the other night. But she never bothered, you know, so you got her panties back. And that was the sort of unspoken language that went on. You had to be very, very discreet. I can assure you there are many, many divorces I could have been responsible for had I opened my mouth, and the stewardesses. Yeah. But it was more than your job was worth. Mm. You kept that between you on the deck. You never even told another member of the crew. Although everybody guessed it, you know. Mm. And that sort of thing went on a lot, because, you see, as I say again, there was the lady looked glamorous all the time. Jeeps, drinks were cheap. They had orchestras on the promenade deck and waltzing and all like that. Both the lady and gent had empty cabins down below where they could go. No stewardess. Stewards and stewardesses wouldn't bother. If they did see anything, it wouldn't bother them, because the moral side of it had nothing to do with you. You were simply a member of the crew, and that was it. If they wanted to commit indiscretions, as long as it didn't interfere with you. And this was part of the life of the Western Ocean, a very glamorous life, you know. And another beautiful thing about it was the start of dinner, which is usually 7:30, they'd all be having their cocktails up in the public rooms up on top. And then bugler used to go around, and he'd sound the dress for dinner bugle at 7:00, and then he would sound the 7:30 meant that dinner will now be served, and he'd blow this bugle through the alleyways and on deck and everything, you know, right through the ship at the appointed time for the meal. And all the lady passengers, the gents, they would all start to come down the main stairs into dinner, and some of the ladies, beautiful dresses on, and the hair done beautiful, you know, highlights and everything, really beautiful coming down. Couldn't have nothing else to do but to look beautiful. And we and the stewardesses especially, and we stewards, it was a slack time for us then, having served all the drinks and they were going down to the meal, you know. We would stand and watch them going down and they really looked smart and each woman looked really... It was like a picturesque parade of princes and princesses going down into the main hall, you know. They're going down to the dining room, especially the stewardesses. They were all nudging each other and womanlike, yeah. But it was really beautiful to see that, you know. And it was a real old world, and the orchestra would be playing some beautiful music in the background as they ascended it, you know. Now, when we carried actors and actresses, these people headed off to a fine art. Then the bugle used to sound 7:30, the bugle, the commencement of dinner. Well, the people would begin to descend the main companionway, richly ornate, carved companionway, you know, beautiful. And then they would be down sitting at their tables by about 7:50, with a waiter served them. Not the actors and actresses. They would wait until 8:00 or 8:05. Then they would come down and they would enter the dining room, come down the main stairway coming into the dining room, like a palace, at, say, 8:00 when everybody else was all sitting round their tables dining. And, of course, they were the cynosure of all eyes then, you see, because everybody was, the women and everybody was staring at them then, and they were the real, they headed off to a fine art, that entrance into the dining room, at the psychological moment, you know, that this would, but you could see that these people have been doing it for years, yeah, entering any public room,
yeah,
to obtain the greatest maximum publicity.
Yeah.
But that was life in those steamers of yesteryear. It was a wonderful, wonderful life. And the steward had to be a man of tact, diplomacy, and discretion. And at the same time, he had to know his job. You might get a chap who wouldn't know how to tie a bow tie, and you'd get the bells ringing for different things like that, and you had to. And average questions, you know, you really had to... be able to answer the average questions quickly and right away what they wanted. Oh, yes, it was... pertaining drinks, you know, and some of them would say they want this certain type of drink and,
yeah,
oh, and you have to go up and the barkeeper might be in a bit of a rush and he might try to miss some ingredients from a cocktail and you have to be quick on, hey, you've missed out the such and such a thing, you know. And, you know. But... it was a world in which you had to be smart, but the money was good. And your pay was only, as I say, a little over £8.5 a month, with stoppages and all that sort of thing. It wasn't it wasn't £2 a week, really. It'd be about £35 a week. Well, you would get the trip from Liverpool to New York and back would take roughly 2 weeks. So that was roughly about £3.10. In old money, that's £3.50 of today, in earned capacity, but in your tips would be as much as £12 to £16, you know, and the upper deck men much more. That's why a lot of those men, they all owned their own houses even before the war.
Didn't they?
Oh yeah, when house the average house would be about £600, semi detached, you know, in the gardens, and they used to be about £20 down and 15 shillings a week. Well, these men had the wherewithal to be able to pay that.
But some of them would gamble it away, presumably. Were there gambling schools on the...
Oh, yes, there were gambling schools on there. And this is why I've never, ever gambled in my life. Because as a bellboy, I learned some lessons. Because what they used to do, the men, at the voyage end on Channel Night, which was the night when you were going up the English Channel to your final home port, and you'd receive all your tips, you see, because most experienced travellers always tip the night before they get in. Because next morning there's a rush breakfast and porters carrying away their luggage and all the other doodad and too much of a bit of a mix-up of everything. So they always tipped you the night before, you see.
When they gave you the tip, did they make a thing of it, or were they discreet?
Oh no, very discreet, very discreet.
So how did they?
They generally did it as they finished the meal, and they were sort of getting up hesitantly, you know. And as you went over to perhaps take the plate away from them, they sort of sneak it into your hand, you know. And sometimes they went away from the table, they'd sort of move over to you and just sort of grope for your hand and slide it into your hand.
Yeah.
It was never ever done...
Not in an envelope or anything like that?
No, no. Envelopes you were always suspicious of. People who undertipped you always put the money in an envelope. You see, in the days of the pound note, people used to give you a 10-bob note in the envelope. And by the time you managed to, you couldn't obviously open a sealed envelope in the middle of a dining room full of people. You would open it perhaps 20 minutes, half an hour after you managed to get away. And when you open the envelope, there's only a 10-bob note in, you see. So you never liked envelopes. There's certain, in the tipping area, there's certain things which you were gradually became aware of. You gradually became aware of that the two worst tippers in the world are Australians and New Zealanders.
Really?
Yeah, very, very mean. Not so much because they are mean, in as much as that they don't like tipping because they are socialistic-minded people and they are putting themselves higher than you if they tip. Even if you, in the old days, you went for a drink in Australia and offered to buy the bar lady a drink, she or he would say, no thanks, no thanks, Sam. I got enough money for doing my job. So based on that, Australians and New Zealanders were the worst tippers in the world. And they were always given to what we call cowboys. They even had that expression before the war. Cowboys were waiters who weren't quite as good as the proper... man, careless, in other words. Mm. Well, you always gave him a woman travelling with kids, or Australians or New Zealand, or coloured people, or people like that who are notoriously bad tippers. The reason for coloured people and widows with children, obviously, they didn't have the money. But Australians and New Zealanders were always aggressive, hostile, irate diners. And yet they were poor tippers. You know, they were the sort of people that send stuff back and all like that. Whereas the English and Americans say, oh, no, that's all right, you know. But anyway, that was the tipping side of it. So the best tippers were what you call singles. That was usually American, either male or female, travelling alone, are the best tippers. Second to those are the upper-class English type, the type with the southern public voice accent. A jolly good chair, say look here old boy, or well, it was a prank old boy. That type were always good tippers. Irish people were good tippers. Clergy were always good tippers.
Really?
Nuns or priests, because these clergymen are given the tip by their superiors. Before they come aboard the ship, you see. Actually, nuns are a very good... Because you didn't get many of those on the Western Ocean run, but you got a lot of them on the West African run missionaries, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And they were very poor, very tiny eaters, but good tippers. And they were always in first. And they were away first, you know. Not like some passengers who used to be drinking and wouldn't come in until about 8:10, you know.
Mind you, the nuns wouldn't be much good to the stewards and the public rooms, presumably.
No.
Doing a lot of drinking.
Oh, yes. I remember one, to come back to my bellboy days, I was born and reared from a Catholic mother and father who were wonderful people, but they were religious bigots, unfortunately, but otherwise they were wonderful people. And I remember I went to sea and probably about my third or fourth trip, and the bell was pressed in the room, and I went to answer the room, and in this room were four nuns, you see. The cabins were two berth, so, and these cabins next to each other had two nuns in each. So the two nuns came out of one cabin and went into to join the other two preparatory for an aperitif before dinner. And when I went in there, there were four nuns, you see. So they said, we want four dry martinis. So I said, yes, all right, yes, all right, four dry martinis, and we want the olive, don't forget the olive, and all right, sister, yeah. And the wife bounds upstairs for these four dry martinis, complete with olives, and took them down to them. And I thought, Christ, I'd never known nuns to drink. My mother always told me that. Nuns always wear halos. Nuns and priests, they always wear halos. They don't drink or do anything that human beings do. So I brought these drinks in, and they were very good to me. Thanks, Bells. And they paid me. They didn't sign cards or anything like that, the nuns. They paid me and gave me a tanner for myself. And that was a regular thing before dinner with these four nuns, you see. So when I went home and I told my mum about this incident, my mum blew up the air. Don't you stand there and tell me that holy nuns drink. Holy nuns don't drink. And she told me she'd give me a clip over the ear if I told her, so I wisely shut up. Now, that's perfectly true, yeah. She wouldn't believe her own son that I said, nuns drinking cocktails, nuns drinking aperitifs. Well, she didn't. She wouldn't know the meaning of the word aperitifs. Nuns drinking cocktails before dinner. I won't have that at all from a son of mine. So I wisely shut up. They were very, very good, kindly people, nuns. Mm. And we were always happy when we got them, and they were of no trouble at all.
Was there any difference between Protestant and Catholic clergy?
No. They all tipped the same.
Generous
and good, kindly person. Never kick up a row or protest or... Not that you did, monks. Not that you did, because the service was so good. The efficiency of the servants, the bedroom stewards, waiters, smoke room stewards, and everyone, were so well trained, these men. And there were so many years in the ship that it was imperative with them that they must do their job properly, because they would lose their damn job. And if you lost your job in those days, it took you an awful long time to get another one, you know. So therefore, they didn't really have a great deal to... kick over the first-class passengers.
Yeah.
Not to complain over, really.
Yeah.
And their evening dress was always laid out for them on their bunks preparatory for dinner and all this, you know.
Would you ever talk much amongst yourselves about the passengers? I mean...
Yes.
Passengers were a subject of conversation.
Oh, yes. In the glory holes, which was the accommodation in those days, we slept about 12 men in each room, usually. And... we would always get discussing the passengers amongst us and their idiosyncrasies, and especially with the ladies. And you'd get one gentleman from, say, Stanley Road would say to a gentleman from Club Moor, "You know that Mary one? She's all right, you know, she's all right." And all this. And they were the...
Would they mimic... You mimic passengers.
Oh, yeah. And, how can I put this? Some of the indiscreet stewards who hadn't got rid of their inner city ways and their idiosyncrasies would talk like that, and especially if they were men who didn't have much to do with passengers, like... Stewards, or men who worked in the galleys and all like that.
Yes.
And had been told something about something else and all like that. Well, that was the talk, you know. But the stewards themselves, they would be very tactful when they told each other. You know the Honourable Lady Williams in the cabin? She's very good after a fourth or fifth cocktail, you know. Mm. All right, yes, all right. That was the end of the incident.
Yeah.
And then you see you were...
So the people who would be most interested would not be your fellow stewards, but the people who had relatively little contact with the passengers, like the galley staff.
That's correct.
Glory
yeah,
stewards
yeah.
And people like that.
So one had to be very careful what one said
but
to those gentlemen.
So you rationed out.
Oh, my word, yeah.
Yes.
Your tact and discretion dealing with those, you know.
Yes.
And the only time they'd might hear anything would be if two first-class waiters were having a shave together. And perhaps the chap on the other side in the washbowls, he might be the assistant cook, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And he might be shaving as well, first thing in the morning. Well, you might be discussing somebody with the other first-class waiter. And you're unaware that this man is on the other side of the mirror shaving away, and he might make one or two discreet remarks. Well, naturally, his ears would stand up. Oh, a little bit of scandal. Something to talk about, you see.
So you talk more amongst yourselves.
Oh, yes.
Than you would with other
sections. Like most tradesmen. Tradesmen do this. Yes.
Plumbers talk to plumbers.
Indeed, plumber language.
Yes.
And that was the way we did. Oh, yeah. There's a certain amount of, as I say, snobbery in ships, you know, and for instance, stewards always considered themselves far above sailors and firemen. They would never go ashore with firemen or sailors. And when I was a boy, as a bellboy, you would never be seen going ashore as a deck boy, with the deck boys, or anybody like that. You know, if you're not of your own department.
Yeah.
Because the second steward would call, he was the working man on the ship. And the second steward, he would call you on one side and he'd say, I saw you going ashore with two deck boys last night. Don't do it again. Go ashore with other boys of your own ilk, your own department, not deck boys. Deck boys wear overalls. They are far below you. And that was it, you see. Which is why I never wore, wearing overalls, you never ever wore overalls when you were a steward. You always had a dark blue pair of working pants called scrub outs, which you use for cleaning. But when it comes to passengers and dining rooms and all like that, you had your number one blues, which you put on then, of course. But you never ever wore overalls, because overalls were always a sign of deck or engine working class people. You know, you were taught to be a snob, really. And even now, I've never worn a pair of jeans in my life, that they call them nowadays, because they're overalls. And even now, I gaze frowningly at people who wear jeans. Honestly, it's that imbued in me after all these years. Because, as you and I know, the things that you were taught when you were young last longest.
Oh, they stick, don't they? Yeah, they certainly do. So, what different? Can you just briefly tell me what ships? You did mention some of the ships that.
Yes.
You started as a bellboy on the Voltaire.
On the Voltaire, yes.
And how long did you stay on her?
I was on her for the season because she was a cruising ship, you see.
Oh, was she going out to Norway?
She went out on 13-day cruises.
Oh, yes.
And she sailed from Southampton, and her sister ship, the Van Dyke. Lambernault Lines always called them after famous French philosophers and painters, as Voltaire and Van Dyck. And they would do 13-day cruises then, you see, and they would go to perhaps Norway, Sweden, Denmark, one trip, and then the next trip they go down to Las Palmas, Madeira, and Portugal, and be back on the 13th day. And then the next trip they may go to France and Spain, Santander and places like that. And all of them were 13. And they were £1 a day. £13.
Yeah.
For a cruise looked after by people like that.
Yes.
And that was your, that was the voyages of them, you see. Well, then they finished in September and they laid up those ships then, you see. They went down to one of the locks off Cornwall and they laid up down there till the next season. Well, the men were stopped. They were fired then until the following season. Well, then they had to go and find work somewhere else. Well, of course, the Elder Dempster's running down to our the Empire in those days were busy 52 weeks in a year. But the trouble with Elder Dempster's was it was a malaria zone. And if you went to Elder Dempster's, invariably you caught malaria. I did, and I was in the tropical hospital for 2 weeks with malaria when I was only 16 and a half with malaria. And as a bellboy, you know. And you were caught malaria in Elder Dempster's. And that's why a lot of people used to keep away from Elder Dempster's. But the money was there, you know, during the winter. And jobs were available when you couldn't get them in the summer. You couldn't, I beg your pardon, you couldn't get them in the winter.
Yep.
Summer, there was plenty of jobs. Then other people went to Royal Mail Line and PSNC, which were into Buenos Aires and Rio de Janeiro and places like that. And they carried, they were mostly passengers from you picked up in France, a place called La Palice. Mm. You'd leave Liverpool, you'd go to La Palice. Then from La Palice, then you would go all the way over to South America, calling it Recife, and all the way down that coast.
Yeah.
And back, well, you would get a lot of British people, but they were mostly Spanish people. Well, they weren't bad tippers. South Americans, Argentinos and Brazilians, they weren't bad tippers because they were a lot of Americanized, if you know what I mean, regarding tipping. You didn't go to continent because it was too long away, you see. There were usually 3 months on the Australian, maybe 3.5 months on the New Zealand run. Well, you could only manage one trip on there. You certainly couldn't manage two, because by the time you came back after the second voyage on, say, a New Zealand run ship, all the jobs had been snapped up for the summer trade across the Western Ocean.
So you always tried to make sure that you could time it to get back on...
preparatory to the start of the either the Western Ocean run,
yes,
or the cruising,
yes,
ships, you see.
I see. So it would be a normal thing for people to move around at different seasons of the year following the traffic.
Well, they did. They did in the seamen's... they did in the catering department. The ABs and...